Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome, everybody, to a special edition of The Dragon's Lair. Tonight's topic will be the paranormal, and the setting will be Russia. And as my description says in the Blog Talk Radio page, it says the paranormal does not mean occult or supernatural. It has nothing to do with religion of any kind. The definition of paranormal basically is that which demonstrably exists but lies outside the accepted normal of the society and the culture that surrounds it. Therefore, it is to be investigated and not relegated to the realm of superstition. For the record, today is October 19th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 25 degrees Libra. Again, I have no website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe to be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe. Otherwise, you can just write me. I can't guarantee that I can answer all of my emails, but I will read them. As usual, there will be no calls, certainly no need for them tonight. I got the cat sitting on the chair behind me here, and dog is in the other room. So normally I would play a song about this time, but I see no reason to do that. I'm just going to go ahead and dive right in. These are short stories that have come out of Russia, and the stories themselves are real. These are not just somebody's imagination, and they all have a geographic location. And when I'm done with however many shows of these that I will do, I will give everybody the name of the book and the author's name and where they can buy it for themselves. Now, these stories, just FYI, they're not horror stories. They're certainly acceptable for most age groups. You know, some of the younger ones would not grasp some of the things in them, but there's nothing in it that's X-rated or weird or bizarre or any monsters or anything like that. So you'll see once I get into it. So I'll read a couple of them and then take a break and play a song, then come back and read some more. I don't know how long I will go tonight. Kind of just all depends on how I feel after reading for a little while. We'll see how it goes. So anyway, the first story I have is called Lady in the Lamplight. Major Anatoly Shushkin is retired. He finally hung up his badge in the spring of 1999 and moved, more or less permanently, into his long-neglected little flat in Mamontovka, a tiny suburb some 25 miles northeast of Moscow, with his wife and two teenage daughters. For more than 28 years, he had looked forward to a time when he could forget about being commandant of the Pushkina police barracks and devote his life to his true loves, fishing, drinking, and his family, not necessarily in that order. However, Anatoly had made somewhat of a reputation for himself as a solver of mysteries in his almost 30 years in the national police, using a combination of skill, tenacity, intuition, and just plain old dumb luck. He had solved some difficult cases, not the least of which was the case of the unknown soldiers seen at the Ukha River Bridge. I think I pronounced that correctly. It's U-C-H-A. Because of this, he is frequently called on to consult with local authorities on similar matters, especially those concerning the paranormal, in an unpaid capacity, of course. This is Russia, you know. In late November 1998, Shukin received a call from his successor, Captain Maxim Gorshkov, the new commandant of the Pushkina police barracks. It seemed Gorshkov had been receiving complaints of a lady of the evening frequenting a certain location in downtown Pushkina. The young woman in question was seen almost every night, leaning against a lamppost near the railway platform. No one had noticed her at first, but her appearance at the same spot, night after night, finally caused some of the local residents to complain. It was obvious, they said, what she was. The girl, apparently in her early 20s, began showing up at the station about the time a military Engineering Battalion arrived to demolish several of the older buildings in the area, including the old, long-abandoned Gostinista, or hotel, to make room for a new extension to the depot. Most residents of the immediate area were glad to see this, since the abandoned buildings had become a notorious hangout for the local drunks. The girl by the lamppost was tall and of average build, with blonde hair cut in what Westerners would call a page boy style that had gone out of fashion in most places years before. She was dressed in knee-high boots with spike heels, a short skirt, and a fur coat. Night after night, the reports came in, and night after night, Gorshkov would dispatch his troops to no avail. The girl was always gone by the time they arrived, and no one seemed to remember seeing her go. Finally, one night, someone did see her go, and it was at this point Gorshkov telephoned Shukin. The girl had simply vanished, seemingly into thin air. She was there one minute, the next she was gone. After a short visit to Gorshkov's office, during which Shukin collected copies of each report concerning the girl, along with a collection of descriptions of the young woman, a startling picture began to emerge. The girl would appear at the railway station at precisely the same time each night. She was always dressed in the same clothing and would always assume the same position, leaning against a lamppost outside the old Gostinista, the hotel, smoking cigarette after cigarette. Her clothing was slightly out of date, and she seemed to be waiting for someone or something, as every few minutes she would make as if to check her wristwatch, then look nervously down the railroad tracks toward Moscow. If undisturbed, she would stay in that place all night until first light, then vanish. Shukin began his investigation. First, he questioned all the witnesses. Their stories were all the same, although few of those questioned knew each other, and those who did had not mentioned the incident to others. He then questioned the members of the engineering battalion. Did any of them meet the girlfriend or wife after completing an evening shift? In all cases, the answer was no. Shukin then went through all of the files on known prostitutes working in the area. None matched the description of the lady in the lamplight. None of the girls knew anyone matching the description. After three fruitless, unpaid weeks, Shukin gave up on the logical solutions and began delving into the possible paranormal explanations. He went to the local newspaper, a weekly called the Golos Pushkina, and went through all of the back issues for the past 20 years, looking at accident reports and obituaries. He selected that period based on the style of clothing the girl was reported to wear. He found nothing. He went back through them again, this time more carefully, looking for homicides and missing persons reports. Bingo. On November 28, 1973, a girl named Valentina Usakova had disappeared from the Pushkina Railway, Gostinitsa, where she had been staying overnight, waiting for a connecting train. She had last been seen just outside the little hotel, smoking a cigarette and looking down the tracks toward Moscow for the train, which was at that time slightly overdue. Let me cough for a quick. The major then went back to the Pushkina police barracks and dug into the old records of missing persons. There, too, he found his woman. He had not discovered the report in his earlier examination of the records because it had been filed in Moscow by the girl's mother, and only several days later had a copy been sent to Pushkina. The description given in the report matched the lady in the lamplight, exactly, down to her hairstyle and her manner of dress. There was even a photo of her in the file. Shukin now had something to go on. Several employees of the old Gostinitsa remembered the incident and were happy to talk about it. No, the girl had not been drinking. She had appeared worried, nervous, but otherwise quite normal. The weather had been unusually bad that night, with an unseasonably early heavy snow. One man, a former porter for the railroad, remembered seeing the girl standing in front of the hotel smoking when the inbound freight from Yaroslavl passed. Yaroslavl. He had glanced at the train, noticing that it was going unusually fast, trying to make up lost time, no doubt. When he looked back over toward the girl, she was gone. The major now had an idea. The next morning, he visited the old Gostina Itza once more and looked over the scene carefully. It was just as he had thought. The lamppost where the girl was being seen stood directly in front of an elevated platform attached to the front of the old hotel, exactly halfway between the platform and the tracks, a distance of less than 8 feet. At the time, the area would have been covered with snow. Early the following day, Shukin, accompanied by members of the 2nd Company of the 24th Engineering Division, returned to the scene. By noon, they had managed to excavate a 10-yard-long strip running beside the tracks in front of the old hotel. At around 3 o'clock that afternoon, they found what they were after. Human remains located just north of the lamppost. Medical examination showed the remains to be those of a young woman between the age of 20 and 30. Cause of death was determined to be exposure, she most likely having been knocked unconscious and buried in the snow. There was a minor fracture of the skull, but it was not, according to the examining physician, fatal in nature. His best guess was that the girl had been struck by some object thrown off by a passing train, knocked unconscious, covered in snow by the same train, shortly to die of exposure and hypothermia. The remains were eventually returned to Moscow to the girl's aging mother for burial. The lady in the lamplight was never seen again. Shukin concludes that the girl was trying to let the engineering battalion know where to find her body, as it would most likely not have been discovered otherwise. The new station extension and platform covers the site at which she was found with an 8-foot thick layer of concrete. All right, that was the end of that one. Let me light this cigarette. These are going to be various lengths. Some are shorter than others. Some are really short. Some are a little long, but not real, real long. The next one that I'm going to read is, it's several pages here. So this one will probably take a good, at least 10 minutes or so to read. This one is called Legion of the Damned. Eastward, ever eastward, pushing ahead into the very teeth of the fierce Siberian winter, wading through snowdrifts that approach the bridle bit of the solitary officer's horse, the battered little company forges on. The people whose paths they cross call them the Legion of the Damned. Perhaps they are. Their uniforms, what is left of them, are in rags. Their feet are covered in bits of blanket to supplement the minimal warmth provided by their worn boots. Still, they march with pride and in formation. On rare occasions that they pass through some remote village, the company's lone drummer breaks out with a cadence that brings the straightness back into their bent spines, and a look of stern determination to their haggard faces as their color bearer comes to the front with their shredded, battle-scarred banner. They pass in silence. Only the staccato beat of the drum and the rhythm of their hobnailed boots on the street announces their presence. Bayonets, the officer's saber drawn and presented as if on a formal parade, they stare straight ahead, without so much as a sideways glance towards the people who stare at them from the shuttered windows and barred doors of their homes. I had to turn a page. The soldiers are followed by a pathetic baggage train of push carts and small two-wheeled wagons. Haggard, tired-looking women and children serve as human beasts of burden, guarded and watched over by the men, dressed in the remnants of finery, ragged blankets, and furs, adding warmth to their tattered garments. They are not prisoners. They are following their men in a self-imposed march of exile. They are in retreat, but their bearing does not show it. They are beaten, but not defeated. Fewer than 50, they are all that is left of a once mighty army. From town to town, they march on, all the way from St. Petersburg in the far northwest to the frozen waste of Siberia and the banks of Lake Baikal in the Asian steppes. 6,500 miles of wasteland lie in between. 6,500 miles of frozen hell. What started out as an army is now reduced to a single understrength rifle company, a lone officer whose mount is as starved and worn as its rider, and the pitiful but proud little band of women. On and on they march through the forest and through the swamp, in the rain and in the snow, across the mountains and onto the desolate, deserted steppes, looking for a place to stop, a place of refuge in which to regroup and prepare to fight again. Hounded and pursued by an unseen foe, followed from afar by a victorious host bent upon revenge, they press ever onward, never looking back, never stopping unless it is to resist their pursuers, to delay them, to hold them at bay as they mount their embattled withdrawal into the vast emptiness and relative safety of Siberia. Their tattered ranks are met by stares and silence in the few villages through which they pass. Doors are barred against them. The villagers cross themselves, meaning like a Catholic will do a cross over their chest. The villagers cross themselves and look to the sky. No one dares mention their passing aloud, not until they are long gone. To most, they are nothing more than phantoms in the night, their passing relegated to knowing glances and innuendo. Children hide their faces in their mother's aprons. Dogs and cats cower under the houses at their passing. Their presence is something whispered about in private, something told in the still of the night, in the quiet of the home. It is something that is not mentioned in polite company. Their presence is not, as it were, a good omen. Yet in 100 villages all across Russia, they have been seen, always the same, unchanging as they soldier on toward a seemingly ever elusive goal, for truly no place in all of Russia is safe for them. No place offers what they seek, what they have sought for so long. No villager will help them. None would dare even if they could. They cannot find sanctuary even in the church, that haven known to all Russians. Everyone knows, every village priest, all about the patriarchal edict that excommunicated these men and all these those like them. Dekabristi is the word that is used for them. They are the Decembrist, the last survivors of an uprising that ended in ashes, the remnants of the cream of the Imperial Russian Army. Four elite regiments that rose in righteous wrath against a callous and uncaring government for land reform and freedom for the long oppressed and abused serfs of Russia a generation before our grandfathers' fathers were born. They are not pursued by an earthly foe. Their revolution failed in 1825, the Great December Uprising against Tsar Alexander I. His little company, one of a handful that managed to escape the bloodbath of executions that followed the collapse of the uprising, the Legion of the Damned, has been marching toward the east for more than 175 years, but the end is not yet. Through the years, there have been many tales told about phantom armies. They range from tales of soldiers still locked in the great battles of the American Civil War at places such as Gettysburg and Shiloh to Pictish warriors in Britain. No nation is without its legends and myths of soldiers still attempting to carry on the battle. But some of these tales are more than myth. Some of them, like Russia's Legion of the Damned, have been seen and reported for decades, for more than a century, and documented well enough and thoroughly enough to place them outside the bounds of urban legend and put them solidly into the class of a genuinely unexplained, unexplainable phenomenon. Their story is very real, and in many ways a touchingly tragic episode in this country's long and bloody history. A tiny chapter of that history that is still going on. It is a story of a brave little band of soldiers who gave their all for a cause, of a group of men and women who chose exile and death over comfort and the toleration of slavery. On the overcast winter morning of December 14, 1825, the first Russian revolutionaries, who came to be known as the Dekabristi, marched into the center of St. Petersburg. At the head of their regiments, with colors flying, the men of the four elite regiments who were marching on the square that morning were mostly heroes of the Patriotic War of 1812. They were the man who had brought Bonaparte to his knees. They were the men who had saved Russia. They were the men who now wanted to bring freedom and a more humane government to their people. These men were described at the time as highly educated, gifted men, some of them extremely talented, high-minded, noble, and courageous, inspired by radical ideas brought home from France during the Napoleonic campaigns. The young officers tried to depose the new emperor coming into power, Tsar Nicholas I. Technically speaking, Nicholas's older brother, Constantine, should have taken the throne. However, a secret agreement allegedly made before the death of Alexander I, Nicholas I, and Constantine's father, decreed that Constantine had renounced power. After Alexander's unexpected death, Nicholas pledged allegiance to his brother, but began to make preparations for his coronation. Let me clear my throat. To the public and a substantial segment of the army, it looked as though he was usurping the throne from his brother and seizing power for himself. The officers who led the revolt had had enough. They took advantage in the crisis taking place in the royal family to push for the reforms that they and many others desired. The revolutionaries sought a constitutional monarchy bound by the rule of law. They wrote a manifesto that called for the abolition of serfdom and land reform, as well as the convening of an assembly to draft a new constitution for Russia. The uprising was suppressed, but not without bloodshed. Many of the revolutionaries were captured. A bloodbath of executions followed, but some managed to withdraw. They did not escape. They did not surrender to the bloodthirsty revenge seeking monarch in St. Petersburg who had hanged or had shot those men and women who had been captured out of hand or caused them to run a gauntlet of 1,000 men 12 times, sustaining 12,000 blows with iron rods. They did not run for their lives. The soldiers who would not yield to Napoleon would not yield to Nicholas. Instead, they staged an orderly fighting withdrawal across the wide and open expanses of Russia, across the Urals, and into the vast, unexplored wilderness of Siberia. The Great December Uprising was a unique event. What followed its suppression was equally unique. Most hauntings and recurrent apparitions or anomalies are limited to a certain area or location. This one isn't, or at least the area that it is limited to is about 20 miles wide and more than 6,000 miles long. This long band of refugees can and does appear at dozens of points along a well-documented and historically provable line of march. This group was a rear guard that purposely lagged behind the rest of a far larger refugee column. They were the ones charged with the defense of the column as a whole, who made a stand in the Ekaterinburg Gap to delay pursuit while the rest put more distance between themselves and the pursuing loyalist forces. They were almost wiped out, but managed to beat off the Tsar's troops and continue the march east. They never reached their destination. No one knows where the last of them died or how close they came to safety. However, there is a little monument in Irkutsk, I-R-K-U-T-S-K, to their memory, the 2nd Imperial Guards Infantry Regiment. One must note that one aspect of this haunting verifies yet another historically verifiable fact. When the men of the 2nd Imperial Guards Infantry stayed behind to fight off the forces pursuing the Decabristi, their women would not leave them. Knowing that, outnumbered dozens to one, most of their men would surely die in the bloody snows of the Ekaterinburg Gap. They chose to make their stand with the men and to face the same fate. In the aftermath of the rebellion, some, though not many, of the Decabristi made good their escape and settled on the shores of Lake Baikal in extreme eastern Siberia. Their children's children's children are still there today, proud to be the descendants of those who are among the first to rise up for the cause of freedom in this vast land, which is Mother Russia to all of them. Yakutsk, the city they built up from a mere gathering of crude huts, is equally proud today to be the city of the Decabristi. This little band, however, the Legion of the Damned, never made it. They vanished somewhere in the Urals. They have since been spotted all over Russia. Their line of march has been traced year after year from St. Petersburg through the outskirts of Moscow, always eastward across the Urals and on to the vast steppes of Asiatic Russia, all the way to Lake Baikal. There is hardly a village along that torturous route that has not had
There is hardly a village along that torturous route that has not had and does not still have reports of their passing. Unlike many repetitive sightings, the very nature of their reports coming in about the Legion of the Damned and the nature of those who report seeing them changes the perspective with which one views such incidents. As investigators of the paranormal, most of us are familiar with repeated stories such as the Phantom Hitchhiker and Chicago's Resurrection Mary, which are told over and over, changing only in location and minor detail. In all such cases, it is generally a desire to bring publicity to an area or a quest for personal notoriety that prompts the reports. In the case of the Decabristi, this is absolutely not the case. Russian farmers in tiny villages, usually a superstitious and rather clannish lot, have nothing to gain from such reports. In a country in which bringing attention to oneself for generations, a dangerous, often fatal thing to do, old practices die hard. It is highly unlikely to the point of being absurd that a farmer in Brabinski Oblast would make such a report on a whim or to seek any sort of publicity for himself or his area. The prying eyes of the press, and particularly the government, are singularly unwelcomed by most people in this country. In the more rural the area, the more likely this is to be so. Let me clear my throat again. Likewise, the number of official reports by police and border guard units precludes hoax. No serving member of a police or border guard formation would file such a report unless he had numerous witnesses and solid documentation. Keep in mind that the first thing that would come to a superior's mind would be the possibility of drunkenness on the part of the reporting officer. And for about 80 years, drunkenness on duty was an offense that could and would get an officer shot. Even today, it is cause for immediate termination. Very few men will risk a career, their family's livelihood, and their retirement pension on a lark. One might tell such stories to children, but one would never attach one's name to an official document unless the testimony in that document were certainly and verifiably accurate and true. Several times over the years, the deck of Bristy had been encountered by police patrols, army units, and yearly by the populations of dozens of small villages. They have been the subject of television coverage and live radio reports. Their story has graced the pages of practically every newspaper in Russia. Every year, beginning in December, they are spotted. Every year, until they finally disappear over the Urals through the Ekaterinburg Gap and pass through Perm, they are followed by the curious and occasionally pursued when a report is fresh enough for some group, usually police or army, to do so. Soviet, now Russian, Army and Border Guard archives record dozens of encounters with the Dekabristi. In late December 1956, a Border Guard cavalry troop on a routine patrol through the Ekaterinburg Gap encountered and exchanged fire with this little band when they refused to halt their march. The range was extreme, but the soldiers of the December uprising formed ranks and volleyed with their muskets into the oncoming mounted patrol. Lieutenant Anatoly Sarakin states in his engagement report, dated the 28th of December 1956, that the subjects, armed with weapons of the last century, fired two volleys at our patrol to no apparent effect, then simply disappeared into a dense mist that appeared to form around them. Sarakin's report was substantiated by that of his second-in-command, Sergeant Mikhail Glazov, who was later questioned in ignorance of his commanding officer by Soviet Ministry of Internal Affairs officials concerning the encounter. Glazov's interview statement, transcribed into the official MVD archives and dated 4th of January 1956, states the following. We first sighted them at a distance of approximately 200 meters and close to perhaps half that. They were completely silent. There was not a sound of any kind except for the sounds of the wind and our own horses. We had not expected to encounter anyone. The weather was horrible, with light snow driven by a strong wind. It was nearing evening when we approached them, and we were looking for a place to make camp for the night. The officer in charge of the party, who was on horseback, formed his soldiers into two ranks. We watched them as they calmly and silently loaded their antique weapons. The officer, motionless on his horse, held his saber in the air. One loading was complete. He lowered the sword and the first rank fired. There was a thick cloud of smoke, but no sound. Immediately after firing, this line of troops, maybe 10 of them, but certainly no more, withdrew through the second rank and took up a position nearer to a shabby location collection of pushcarts and what appeared to be a group of women and children, then reformed their line and proceeded to reload as the rank that was left behind, about the same number, fired at us. Upon seeing what they were preparing to do, we immediately dismounted and took up a defensive position. However, no musket ball reached our party. We returned fire with our PP Shahs. Now, this is in parentheses. It says submachine guns. This was a standard issue for police and border guard units at the time. We returned fire with our PP Shahs, but had no effect on them, even though the range of our weapons is far greater than those they seem to be using. Upon returning fire, a cloud or dense fog formed around the group, and they disappeared from our view. We never saw them again, although we conducted a thorough search of the area both that evening and the next morning. End of report. In December and January 1998, the little band was encountered by a police patrol conducting a routine check of the rail line between Barabinsk and Novosibirsk. Yeah, I got it right. In his official report filed in Barabinsk on the 16th of January 1998, Sergeant Vladimir Ustinov states that he and officers Dmitry Vorchinnikov and Alexei Antonov encountered the Dekabristi on two separate occasions between the 28th of December 1997 and the 2nd of January 1998. In both instances, at a distance of less than 100 meters, Sergeant Ustinov categorized the former soldiers of the Tsar and their followers as impossible to mistake, and said that on both occasions, his patrol followed the band at a distance for some 10 kilometers before they finally disappeared into a fog bank, never to appear again. On four separate occasions, in 1962, 1970, 1981, and 1993, the tattered little army was spotted and tracked for a time by air. In each instance, the aircraft lost sight of the ragged company as it entered a dense fog bank and did not emerge again. Several attempts have been made to photograph the proud and defiant troop, but in all cases, the resulting negatives have shown only an amorphous haze, a cloud-like shadow covering the entire frame. On the 29th of December 1993, noted Russian photographer Alexander Bordulin accompanied an ORT crew, and ORT means Russian State Television, by helicopter to a small village on the outskirts of Ekaterinburg to attempt to photograph the Dekabristi. Borodolin was in the city conducting a photographic documentation of the change in the town's name from Sverdlovsk to pre-revolutionary name when the report came in and he was invited to join the expedition. Upon his return, his comments to several of the assembled observers, as related both by himself and others involved in the expedition, were direct and to the point and mirrored his frustration. It is inconceivable that $10,000 worth of Hasselblad equipment captured nothing. I saw them with my own eyes. They were as solid as you and I. He later repeated the same comments to field investigators from Angels of the Battlefield, the Western Russia Paranormal Investigative Society. Bordulin, who is a skeptic with regard to the paranormal, nevertheless expresses his conviction that what he saw was consistent with the story of the Dekabristi and that obtaining photographic evidence of their existence would be a great achievement for the photographer who manages to do so. Again, between the 25th of December 2003 and the 18th of January 2004, the Dekabristi were reported by the ORT, again, the Russian State Television, affiliates in Ekaterinburg, Perm, and Barabinsk to have been sighted by local farmers and ranchers as they trudge wearily to the east. It is important to note that these locations are widely separated, and there is, for all practical purposes, no possibility of collusion among the parties reporting the sightings. In the case of the December 2003 sightings, ORT Television dispatched a film crew by helicopter, and although the entire crew witnessed the spectacle of the Dekabristi marching through an open field near Barabinsk on the evening of the 2nd of January 2003, the video footage that was shot produced nothing but electromagnetic snow when viewed. Interestingly, footage both before and after the 10 minutes or so that the crew followed the troop, surveying them from above, was completely normal. This was brought out in both a live report from the scene and in a report given the following day in which ORT correspondent Valery Shupayev recounted the entire expedition, as well as the story, and the sighting reported behind it on a special segment of the evening news shown across Russia. It would appear then that they march on, seeking a goal that will forever elude them, and will do so until some power beyond the scope of man ends their determined but endless wanderings. It has been thus every year since that cold and fateful December in 1825 when it all began. And so, eastward, ever eastward, pushing ahead into the very teeth of the fierce Siberian winter, wading through snowdrifts that approach the bridle bit of the solitary officer's horse, the battered little company forges on. The people whose paths they cross call them the Legion of the Damned. Perhaps they are. With their tattered and bloodstained banner proudly flying, all but barefoot in the Siberian winter's icebound fury and dressed in rags, they soldier on, their eyes hallowed from hunger, staring forward and their backs straight. They are always on guard and watchful of the women and children in their charge, women who would not leave them in their time of greatest trial as they march on and on. There is, it would seem, no rest for the weary and no peace for the damned, but their courage and fortitude, determination and loyalty to a cause spans the centuries, lasting beyond the boundaries of death itself. And so I'm going to play another song here, and I will be right back.
Okay, I'm back. This next one is called The House in the Woods. The old house is in the heart of the forest, about halfway between the villages of Mamontovka and Klizma. It's not easy for an outsider to find. You have to know where it is to get there. It stands at the end of a tiny narrow trail that is overgrown with tall grass and second growth birch trees. Occasionally, one sees signs that this once a well-manicured, tree-lined lane leading to the house of one of the local gentry. In days gone by, those faraway days before the Great October Revolution of 1917 and the six bloody years of civil war that followed, the old house was a place of beauty. Even now, it is on its turreted three-story eminence with high arched roof and crumbling gingerbread framed windows, traces of brightly colored paint and gilded trim preside over the surrounding solitude with a dying shadow of its former grandeur. If one looks hard enough, the remains of several small outbuildings can be seen within the tall grass and underbrush. On close examination, the purpose of some of these buildings can be identified. A stable, a small barn, a blacksmith shop of which only the small forge remains, two small cottages once lived in by servants or visitors to the estate. All are gone now, only the foundations remain. Once the old house was the centerpiece of a great estate. Once its occupants ruled the entire region, including the little villages of Mamontovka and Klizma. It is a dark place, and even though the old house has long stood abandoned, few have dared to mount the broad marble steps leading to the colonnaded porch and cross the threshold into the cavernous empty ballroom behind the sagging double oak doors. Many believe the house, which was once the home of Count Vislav Mamontov, executed by order of a people's tribunal in the dark days of the Civil War for counter-revolutionary activities, to be haunted, although in fact it is not. They avoid the old house and its grounds with religious fervor. Not far away, across the tiny overgrown lane, is an equally tiny clearing in the forest. Nothing grows there. In the summer, this small bare patch is littered with the ashes of cooking fires lit by local hikers and picnickers. It is cool there, quite a bit cooler than the surrounding forest, even in the dog days of summer, when the temperature there climbs to the low 90s. You can tell this is written by someone who is familiar with the American temperatures, distances, etc., etc. And you'll understand later how it is that something that's written about something in Russia has all of these references that you would recognize. It is a common resting place and a lure to the curious who want to have a look at the old house but lack the courage to make a closer approach. It is quite beautiful in its forlorn sort of way. Of course, the sightseers all depart before evening, before the last long shadows of the day overwhelm the crumbling old house. Only the very brave or the very drunk go near the place after dark. Perhaps, though, if they stayed a bit longer, they would discover what really haunts the secluded spot. Perhaps, if they remained, as some have, they would hear the slamming of a door, the footsteps in the forest, and the sounds of a man being dragged toward them. Perhaps they could hear his cries of protest and pleas of innocence. If they managed to get through this, if they managed to keep their courage up and stay for the finale, they might feel the cold blast of air as unseen figures hustle past them toward the gnarled old oak tree at the upper end of the clearing. They might, if they could bear to stay yet longer,
hear a coarse, rough voice say, "Valesi Rostopov, known as the Count Mamontov, you have been found guilty under Article 6 of the Soviet Constitution as an enemy of the people and the Soviet state." Some say they have, in fact, heard this. That they have heard the old count's continued pleas of innocence. Everyone in Mamontovka, though, has heard what comes next. The sound is quite clear, and plainly heard all over the northern outskirts of the village. It is that same rough voice, hollow-sounding, carried by the late afternoon wind, giving the final commands. Rostov-Dav-Triangan, the spectral, 1, 2, 3, fire. It is followed by the crashing rumble of a volley of rifle shots. Then a split second later, a single, slightly sharper crack of a pistol shot. Then silence. Complete. Utter. Silence. And that ends that one. Some of you may not know, but what they like to do is to tie a person's hand behind their backs, have them get on their knees, and they would push their head forward and take a .22 and shoot them in the back of the head. There are many people in Russia died in that manner. Okay, the next one is called Sverdlov's Ghost. My first paranormal experience in Russia occurred the first day I arrived. This story is not about a ghost that I have seen, but rather one I very much want to see. I shared a suite with him the first week I was in Moscow, but he stayed to himself, and I never saw him. I'm still trying. When I first came to Russia in the fall of 1987, I was with a major international company that had decided to take advantage of the newly opened Russian market. I was one of the three foreigners to come over in the first wave and open an office in Moscow. I arrived on the 5th of November, 1987, with high hopes, a knowledge of the Russian language taught to me by the U.S. military, and a lot of misconceptions. The company, in conjunction with the then Soviet government, had arranged or an apartment for me, but of course it wasn't quite ready when I arrived. This is Russia, you know. Most people know that in those days, 7th of November was a very big holiday in Russia. It was Revolution Day, marking the anniversary of the Great October Revolution. A calendar change made it a November date, next to New Year's Day. It was the biggest holiday of the year. Since my flat wasn't ready for me to move into, the company had to put me up in a hotel, and since it was Revolution Day, every hotel room in Moscow was full. What to do? To everyone's surprise, however, the company found me a room. It was in the Hotel Metropole, the most exclusive and, needless to say, most expensive hotel in Moscow at the time. I not only had a room, I had a three-room corner suite on the top floor that overlooked Red Square, a perfect vantage point from which to watch the Revolution Day parade without standing in the freezing slush of one of the foulest autumns in recorded Russian history. Upon moving in, I noted immediately that this suite must have cost the company a fortune, at least $500 a night, which at that time was an unbelievable sum. Later in 1991, when I came back to Russia permanently in the era of Yeltsinite banditism, it would be nothing, but this was 1987. The Metropole is the oldest hotel in Moscow, and at that time it was the only five-star hotel in the city. My suite was decorated in turn-of-the-century style with thick green carpeting and genuine oak paneling, and it had an elaborately carved ceiling with cut crystal chandeliers in each room. It consisted of a master bedroom, a sitting room, a smaller bedroom that had been converted at some time into a rather ornately decorated, by turn-of-the-century standards, office. The shelves in this office were filled with books in at least six languages, and the desk was well-stocked, as was a liquor cabinet behind it. The furniture throughout the suite was heavy, leather upholstered, and comfortable in an almost decadent way. The bathroom was huge, with a tiled floor and an elaborate mural inlaid with the same tiles that made up the wall. It had one of those fine old porcelain bathtubs that would make Caligula proud, large enough for an entire family. On one wall of the master bedroom was a small plaque which read, "On this spot died Yakov Mikhailovich Sverdlov, People's Commissar, President of the Russian Republic, and First Deputy to V.I. Lenin, 18th of March, 1919. Now I was enthused. The suite was not only beautiful and comfortable, it had history. Being the warm, trusting, and loyal company official that I was, only one thought went through my mind as I began to unpack my things. Something had to be wrong. There was no conceivable reason for a suite this nice to be empty 2 days before a major holiday, and the company would never shell out that kind of money this suite represented if it had any choice at all. Don Martin, the man who was in charge of our overseas operations, was the Scotsman who gave all other Scotsmen their reputation for thrift. I decided to make another, slightly more thorough tour of the suite. Upon looking around more carefully, I was even more confused. The heat worked. The carpet was dry, no leaks, and everything in the bathroom was in working order. I heard a key turn in the lock, and the door into the hallway opened. A maid stepped in. She looked around for a moment and seemed quite shocked to see me in the room, my things scattered on the bed. The woman silently went about her work, straightening the linens, placing new towels, and dusting. Every once in a while, she would look over toward me and stare as though I had two heads. Finally, I asked her what was wrong. Her response was to ask me quite quizzically if I liked the suite. I told her it was beautiful, that I was lucky to get it, and that I couldn't understand why it had stood empty just before the holiday. I went into detail about how well it was furnished and how comfortable it was then, pointing at the little plaque on the wall, said, "This suite even has history." The woman looked at me, smiled, a sweet smile, and pointing to the same plaque said, "It also has a ghost." I never saw Yakov Mikhailovich while I was there. I stayed in the suite for 3 days, and I really looked for him. Sverdlov had been Lenin's deputy. He was Lenin's hand-picked successor, and by all reports, one of the most intelligent and best-informed men in the original cadre of the Bolshevik Party. Had he not died in the great worldwide influenza epidemic, he would have followed Lenin to power, and the Soviet Union never would have been subjected to Stalin, whom Lenin did not care for, and who forged his way into power over an ailing Lenin's signature. I had a couple of questions for Comrade Sverdlov, if I saw him. The first one was, why in hell didn't you wear your overcoat and take a little better care of yourself? I have stayed in the Metropole several times since then, and have visited there on numerous occasions. In all of those times, I have not seen him. I'm still looking. On behalf of 32 million dead, we have some serious matters to discuss. Note, Yakov Mikhailovich Sverdlov was Vladimir Lenin's anointed successor. Had he lived, he would have succeeded Lenin to the leadership of the Soviet Union when Lenin died in 1926. It was the death of Sverdlov, Lenin's refusal to immediately name a replacement, and the power struggle that followed that allowed for the rise of a previously insignificant Joseph Stalin. Stalin was one of history's most vicious butchers, responsible for the deaths of an estimated minimum of 32 million Russians, not counting those who died in the Second World War. End. Let me light a cigarette, and I'll see how long this next one is. It's just a few pages. I'll read it, and then I'll, before I go to another song, let me clear my throat real quick as well. This next one is called Rumblings. Let me get this lit. The city of Tver, T-V-E-R, I guess it's just Ver, city of Ver, once known as Kalinin, is located approximately 100 miles north of Moscow on the St. Petersburg Highway. The little town of 25,000 residents is located halfway between Moscow and Novogorod, about one-fourth of the way to St. Petersburg. It is a quite provincial place, only now showing signs of economic and industrial growth. It is a quaint city, a mixture of the very modern and the very old. It is, generally speaking, a quiet place, far removed from the hustle and bustle of the nearby metropolitan areas. Many foreigners working in Moscow or St. Petersburg live in Ver, and a great many affluent Russians have their second or summer home in the area. David Blake is one such person. David is country manager for a major international company. The nature of his work is such that it really makes no difference exactly where in his region he lives. He is on the road most of the time anyway. David moved to Ver in the summer of 1992. It was the height of the Western invasion of Russia in the aftermath of the August 1991 coup. Now, Russians are fast learners. Even in the early stages of this influx of foreigners, it became obvious to most property owners that foreign companies were not really concerned about money. They were, according to most Russians, chut-chut gluppy, a little stupid. The companies had no idea what the going prices were for rental property, and the owners were quick to take advantage of this ignorance. There was suddenly a foreign price and a local price. Therefore, it rather surprised David Blake when he was able to rent a very nice two-bedroom apartment on the outskirts of Ver for the local price of about $60 per month. He was, of course, suspicious, even though the owner assured him there was nothing wrong with the flat. He gave it a careful examination before signing a two-year lease. It struck him as a little strange that more than half the flats in the building were empty. He found nothing wrong at first. About a week after David moved in, he was awakened by a rumbling. It wasn't particularly bad, just annoying. It was late at night, and the sound and vibration were strong enough to rouse him from his sleep. It sounded like someone operating a bulldozer or heavy tractor right outside his window. Sometimes it was quite loud, and the windows in his third-floor apartment rattled in their frames. At other times, it was faint, almost unnoticeable. David opened his window and looked around carefully, but saw nothing resembling construction work or any other activity requiring heavy equipment. He shrugged, put some cotton wool in his ears, and went back to sleep. The rumbling continued until dawn, then stopped. The next night it was the same. About midnight, the rumbling started. This time it was strong enough to make the floor in his apartment vibrate. Try as he might, he could not sleep. It was now obvious to him why half the flats in the building were empty. This time, when he looked out the window and saw nothing, he decided to take a walk and see what the commotion was. It had to be close by. After circling the block two times and worse than that, hearing nothing, David returned to his building and the infernal rumbling. The next morning, David had to leave on his route and managed to forget about the problem for a while. He was convinced whatever it was making the noise would be gone by the time 2 weeks later when he returned to Ver. He was wrong. His first night back in his flat was as sleepless as the last night he had spent there. This simply had to stop. Determined to find the cause and go to the authorities with the problem, David began questioning other residents of the building. Everyone was suffering, but no one seemed to know the cause of the problem. The city authorities had assured all of them there was no construction or repair work going on anywhere close by. Confronted with this knowledge, David decided the problem had to be something in the building itself. His first guess was a bad water main under the foundation or a malfunctioning heating unit. After discussing this possibility with the building's nashalnik, or superintendent, he was more confused than ever. The superintendent told him the noise came from under the building, but that after digging up every pipe in the basement, including the 12-inch main, he found no cause for the rumbling. He had also uprooted and checked the main conduits from the central heating plant with no results. It had to be something. David asked the Noshnuk, the superintendent, what it would take to dig up all of the pipes and check them out again. The superintendent said quite plainly that it was not difficult at all, but he did not have the equipment to do the job all at once, and the city would not furnish it. He needed a work crew and an excavator, and someone would have to pay for the repair work. David was happy to oblige. His company dealt with oil field service equipment, and he still had the majority of the money his supervisor back in the States had given him to rent an apartment, thinking, of course, that it would be much more expensive than the price David had actually paid. 2 days later, just after noon, one of the company's crews with a small excavator called a ditch witch appeared in Bear. The superintendent opened the double doors leading to the building's basement, bowed, and stood back. And in an hour's time, the entire floor of the basement was being funneled through the doors into a large and growing pile. The first layer of cement and dirt came out. Actually, that should be concrete, not cement. Cement is in concrete. A lot of people don't realize that. The first layer of concrete and dirt came out, exposing the water mains. The superintendent came in and inspected them inch by inch. No damage, no leaks, no problem of any kind, and no cause for the rumbling. The same applied an hour later when the little digging machine reached the heating conduits. David was ready to start screaming. The crew was preparing to go home for the night, and the superintendent was ready for a drink. Then almost in the exact center of the basement floor, some 8 feet below surface level, the ditch witch ground to a halt with a sound of metal grinding on metal as the rotating buckets suddenly ceased. It had struck some sort of large metal object. The superintendent shook his head. Nothing was supposed to be there. The site had been thoroughly gone over some 10 years before when the apartment building was constructed. Shovels came out, and the work crew started to dig. David and the superintendent joined them. 6 sweaty, weary, grimy hours later, the crew had uncovered what appeared to be the rusting hulk of a tank. They worked through the night by the light of a single 40-watt bulb strung into the basement on an extension cord from the first floor. Word spread by morning. More than 60 people, including some 60 history experts, were crowded into the tiny basement dig as an additional 20 or so passed buckets of freshly moved earth out onto the lawn. By noon the second day, for the first time in half a century, the German Panzer 38 tank was free of its tomb. As interesting as this discovery was, the problem had arisen now as to exactly how the thing would be removed from the basement, not to mention that the excavation crew had still not found the source of the mysterious rumbling. However, that could wait. Curiosity had taken over. They all had to see what was inside the thing. Its hatches all closed tightly, sealed by half a century's worth of rust. "Not to worry," said the superintendent with a chuckle. He had his cousin. All Russians have this cousin, the man who can produce anything. The superintendent's cousin happened to work for a metal shop and had access to a cutting torch. In less than half an hour, the excited cousin showed up with his torch. Soon the hatch was off, and all around peered inside. There was a gasp, then some stifled choking noises from some of the women present. Inside the old tank, still sitting at their positions, was the crew, 50 years dead. Apparently, the tank had run off into a ravine and capsized, and the crew was asphyxiated. After the war, the ravine had been filled in to provide building space for the city. No one bothered to remove the tank. What use was it, anyway? It took 2 weeks to dismantle the tank. Eventually, it was cut up or scrapped by one of the local salvage yards. David collected the dog tags of the dead crew and passed them along to the German Embassy Graves Registration Bureau, where the city of Ver stored the remains in the local morgue until they could be either claimed or buried in the local cemetery. David Blake laughs as he tells his story. You see, he's not superstitious at all. He finds it terribly funny that anyone who would think his building had been haunted by the old tank and his dead crew. Still, on the very day the bodies were found, the rumbling stopped. Okay, I'm going to take a short break here and play another song, and we'll be right back. Okay, this next one is called A Tombstone Every Mile. It was winter, and the electric trains that usually pull the weight of Russia's commerce were offline because of the unusually heavy snows. Not so old number 10, she and her sisters, products of the last century, and maintained into this one for just such emergencies soldiered on. Now that train is called Old Number 10. The big black and red steam-powered 686 combine puffed and rumbled through the Urals, shoving the snow aside as it climbed ever higher into the mountains until it reached the dividing line between Europe and Asia, slashing through the snow in temperatures that approached 50 degrees below zero. The big train and its tender, manned by two engineers, four hard-working firemen, and two brakemen, trailed a chain of 21 cars along with a plume of oily black smoke laced with red and amber sparks. Unlike the nearly silent electric trains, Old Number 10 rattled and clacked. The ceaseless throb of its driver rods and mournful wail of its whistle announcing its presence to the world as it passed through the tiny sleeping villages that dotted the iron highway to the east. Sitting in a passenger car in the cozy warmth of a private compartment, drinking excellent Russian champagne and eating caviar on tiny salted crackers, it is easy to imagine yourself in a time long ago, especially as you look out the window and watch the silent birch forest pass by, or a pack of wolves running along chasing the shadow of the engine that a full moon cast on the brilliant white blanket of snow. There is something about the steam trains, something that can't be defined. There is a special kind of luxury to them the world as we know it has generally lost. Most business travelers fly when they have to cross Russia, but the only real way to travel is by rail, and the best way is in the winter, behind Old Number 10, or one of her sisters. It takes a while, but it's worth it. Every 6 hours or so, the big engine slows as it glides into some tiny forgotten station to take on water for the boiler or to pick up a load of mail. Once a day, she stops to take on coal. Old Number 10 has a healthy appetite. At 2 in the morning on the second day of the 10-day odyssey from Moscow to Vladivostok, Number 10 rolled into a tiny station. The sign on the platform said Uriatin, and it was much like the last dozen stations the train had visited on the trip. There was another major stop at a city of any size. There wasn't another major stop at a city of any size until Ekaterinburg in the gap crossing the Ural Mountains. Let me relight this cigarette. Hold on. This tiny station in the Urals was nothing more than a water stop, and Vlad Samsonov, the chief engineer, was not looking forward to getting out of his warm cab and fighting with the undoubtedly frozen water chute on the trackside tower. He had already armed himself and his companions with prize bars and shovels with which to assault the ever-present sheet of ice that barred the door to the cab. Samsonov was a special breed of man. Far past the normal retirement age, he was an expert in the operation of steam locomotives and came out of retirement every winter to operate Old Number 10, just as several of his companions came back to operate the other six steam engines the government kept on standby for particularly foul weather. He generally expected to make about six runs each winter, training new men in the care and feeding of the steam locomotive as they pushed on across the vastness of Mother Russia. Samsonov nodded, and Alexander Chaposhnikov, I guess, the senior brakeman, applied the brakes. The big engine slowed and came to a stop, right on target, just like always, right in the front of the water tower. Samsonov moved toward the door, grimacing as he looked out the window and noticed the ice buildup was even worse than usual. It must be really cold out there, he thought. Unexpectedly, before he could open the cab door, a troop of local workers trampled from the decrepit little station house and began to de-ice the engine, inspect the trucks underneath the cars, and hoist the water chute into position. Samsonov and his companions watched in amazement. This kind of thing just didn't happen. Not anyone, and not for as long as he could remember. The workers moved with speed and determination as they saw to the needs of the big engine. Samsonov counted at least 15 of them. It was funny, he thought. None of them seemed to be really dressed for the kind of weather they were currently experiencing. They looked warm enough, but they were not dressed in winter clothing. They seemed instead to be bundled in several layers of much lighter apparel piled on in the absence of real winter clothing to fight the bitter cold. Not one of them was wearing a proper shapka, a fur hat. In the orange glow seeping from the station house window, Samsonov could see several uniformed figures carrying rifles. That was odd. No, not really, he decided. It's a cold night. The local militia company has come into the station to keep warm. It's not as if there's likely to be any serious crime on a night like this. 2 minutes from the time they stopped, the train was completely de-iced, the boiler filled with water and the trucks oiled. In the dim glare of the station house lights, the foreman of the work gang approached the cab window, took off his tattered cloth cap, grabbed his forelock, and bowed solemnly. Comedian Samsonov thought. He smiled grimly and mimicked the motion as Shapishnikov released the brakes. The big engine started to move slowly forward, lurching a bit at first, but soon gliding in a smooth, liquid motion as the six-foot-tall drive wheels gained purchase on the rails. Early the next morning, old number 10 pulled into Ekaterinburg. It was a one-hour stop since the train had to take on coal and pick up the mail. Samsonov sought out, as usual, Nikolai Stalnov, the station master, and made his report. In passing, he mentioned the excellent service his engine had received in Uriatin. Uriatin, Stalnov asked, are you sure? Absolutely, Samsonov replied. I can't remember ever having the engine serviced there before, but I've never seen such an efficient yard crew. He laughed and then commented on the salute the crew foreman had given him as he pulled out of the station. Comedian, he repeated, this time out loud. Vlad, the station master, had a somber, thoughtful look on his face. He hesitated briefly before he continued. There's no yard crew at Uriatin. There's nothing in Uriatin. Just a water tower. That place has been deserted for almost 100 years. The last time there was an active station there was back when they were building this damn section of the track. What? You heard me. Uriatin was a labor camp. The Tsar sent the people there to get rid of them, to build that bridge over the Oka you crossed just after you left the station. Grandfather Lenin kept it up until the end of the Civil War, but afterward the place was abandoned. But who de-iced and serviced my engine? That I can't tell you. Maybe you were dreaming. Maybe you and your friends were a little drunk. I can't blame you, you know. A little vodka does keep the cold out. I even use it myself sometimes. Nicky, are you accusing me of being drunk on the job? No, Vlad, nothing like that. But are you sure you want to put this in your report, I mean? I'm telling you what happened. If you don't believe me, ask Shapishnikov and the others. And what I am telling you is this. There is nothing in Uriatin, absolutely nothing except the broken-down remains of the old prison barracks, a water tower, and the graveyard where they buried those poor boogers that built the bridge. They died like flies, you know. The Tsar and the Cheka sent them here with nothing. Most of them froze to death or died of starvation. Now, are you still sure you want me to include this in your report? Samsonov shook his head and kept silent. What could he say, really? It runs from the Baltic to the Pacific, but the main stations are Moscow, Kazan, Ekaterinburg, formerly known as Sverdlovsk, Omsk, Novosibirsk, Tomsk, Yakutsk, Khabarovsk, Khabarovsk, and Vladivostok. There's something I can pronounce. It spans 6,000 miles worth of two continents, crosses some of the most rugged and desolate land in the world, and provides a lifeline of freight and passenger transportation within the largest country on Earth. It took more than a century to complete, and most of the work was done by criminals, political prisoners, and prisoners of war. It is a source of myth, legend, and history. It is the Trans-Siberian Railroad, the Zelenznaya Daroga, the Iron Highway that spans the largest single nation on Earth. And as the saying goes, whether you see it or not, there's a tombstone every mile. Let me clear my throat. Okay, end for that one. Let me take a quick drink here. I'm going to mute my mic for okay, the next one here is called Room Service. And it looks like we've still got about a little more than 25 minutes left in the 2 hours. I'll probably stop at 2 hours. David Blake is an American. He tells people that he is from L.A. Most Russians assume he means Los Angeles. He doesn't. He's from Lower Alabama. Actually, but he might as well admit he's a Russian now. Like many of us, his temporary assignment has managed to turn into Gilligan's three-hour tour. He's been here in Russia for almost 10 years, and there doesn't seem to be much chance, hope he says, of his leaving anytime soon. David is the country manager for one of the major oil field support companies now operating in the Russian Federation. And as such, he routinely travels all over the country. He also is a notorious skeptic when it comes to all things paranormal in nature. He is one of those people who look for logical explanations, even if he has to stretch his imagination a bit to find them. Now, David has a rather colorful reputation, especially when it comes to women. He openly admits to having the Mickey Rooney Award for the most marriages in a 10-year period in the Western world, and it is not the least bit bashful of the fact he has a woman in every port. Where most men in his situation might simply boast and brag about this, with him, it happens to be true. Tall, charming, and physically fit, with well-groomed, iron-gray hair and deep blue eyes, he is well equipped for what he calls the most dangerous game. And David not only has a line that is sheer poetry, he can deliver it in five languages. In short, David Blake is what we call here in Russia a babnik, a chronic womanizer. In the summer of 1999, Dave was on one of his frequent inspection tours of the company's assets. This one managed to take him a bit farther afield than usual. As a favor to one of his colleagues, he made a side trip to Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, one of the recently independent republics that had been part of the Soviet Union. It didn't take him long to realize this stop was most likely going to be the most boring 5 days of his life. Uzbekistan is an Islamic republic. His favorite sport was both officially and unofficially frowned upon. In most Islamic republics, a thief is punished by having his hand cut off. David got cold chills thinking of what they probably did to an adulterer. He dug in and prepared for a dry spell. Tashkent is not the Garden of Eden. It has only one decent hotel, the Intourist. Ever since independence, the hotel has tried to encourage tourist trade by using such gimmicks as traditional costuming of its staff and the traditional meals to play up on the city's exotic image as one of the old spice route cities of the Arabian Nights era. David checked in and was taken to his room by a porter dressed like one of Alibaba's thieves. The porter left his bags at the door, bowed, and departed. When David unlocked his door and stepped inside, he got the surprise of his life. He was met by a chambermaid who was a fair imitation of Scheherazade. I think I said that right. It might not be all that bad, after all, he thought. The girl was tall and stately, with the olive skin of her people and large olive-shaped brown eyes that seemed to command David's gaze. For the longest instant, he could not help staring at her. She silently and quickly straightened the room, then, without a word, departed. David tried to give her his customary, enormous, for the area, tip, but she politely refused, smiling as she moved silently past him and out the open door. Dave shrugged and began to settle in. He was tired, and the following day promised to be a long one. He ordered dinner in his room, ate, watched a little television, and turned in early. About midnight, he awoke to find the chambermaid he had seen earlier was back. She was busily cleaning his bathroom and straightening his clothing. Odd, he thought, but this was Tashkent. He got up, slipped on his robe, and tried to stop the girl. She paid no attention to him at all, just went on with her work. He tried to make small talk in every language he knew. She ignored him and kept working. Finally, when things seemed clean and orderly enough to suit her, she started for the door. David once again tried to tip her. Once again, she ignored him and quietly departed. David, who is a former Marine, is a very early riser. He usually gets up around 5 a.m., a habit that is somewhat annoying to most of his travel companions, and equally so to most hotel employees, not so this chambermaid. At 6 a.m., almost as though she knew exactly when he would rise, she was back. This time, she let herself in while David was in the shower. She efficiently laid out his clothing, straightened the room, and made the bed. Before he could get out of the bathroom and confront her, she was gone. David went downstairs, ordered breakfast, and prepared to face the day. At the desk, he had the day manager call him a car and make reservations for supper. He planned to entertain the Uzbeki regional manager that evening. While he was waiting for the car to be confirmed, he commented on the efficient and good-looking chambermaid who had been giving him so much attention. He opened his wallet, took out a $50 bill, and handed it to the manager, asking him to give it to the girl, since she seemed reluctant to take a tip from him directly. Since he did not know her name, he described her to the manager in some detail. The manager stood silently staring at him. "My friend, I would not dream of offending you. Believe me, please, when I say that I think of you as an esteemed guest, it would not insult you for all the world. But have you been drinking?" "What do you mean? This is Uzbekistan. I am in Tashkent. There's no place in this entire city to buy a drink. It's illegal, you know." "I also know that many guests from Russia bring their own supply with them." "No, as a matter of fact, I don't drink at all. Why?" "Sir, please understand, I do not question you. I would not imply that you are less than truthful, and I certainly appreciate your patronage, but..." "But what?" "Sir, then, there is no one on our staff that fits this description, and we absolutely do not allow women, whether employee or not, into a guest room in the evening. It is most strictly forbidden." "Then who was in my room?" "Sir, will you wait here for a moment?" "Of course, I have to wait for my car anyway." The manager looked David up and down gravely. A strange, faraway look clouded his face. "I'll be back in a moment." David picked up a newspaper from the desk and began to read. In about 5 minutes, the day manager returned, accompanied by another somewhat older man who turned out to be the hotel manager. Under his arm was a small leather-bound book, an album of some sort. They came directly up to David, and after the proper introductions, always important in Uzbekistan, the hotel manager opened the book and showed him a photo. The date at the bottom of the picture indicated it was about 5 years old. "Is this the girl that you saw, Mr. Blake?" he asked, a slight note of concern in his voice. Dave looked the photo over and nodded. "That's her," he smiled. "I'd never forget those eyes." The older man, Mr. Iskander, or Iskander, nodded grimly to the day manager, then to David. "Are you absolutely certain?" "No doubt," David replied. "Mr. Blake, I do not know how to tell you this," the day manager began. "I would not want you to leave us. I will be happy to arrange for you another room. Arrange for you a different room. Maybe one of the suites on the top floor." "Why would I want a different room?" Blake interjected as the man continued his long, drawn-out, seemingly pointless apology. "Because, Mr. Blake," Mr. Iskander advised him, "this girl could not possibly have been in your room, not in any way that I can explain, you see." He paused briefly, looking more than a little nervous. "We think that your room might possibly be..." He paused again and took a deep breath. "What is it?" This was getting ridiculous, David thought. "Can you get to the point?" "The point is, sir, this girl is dead. She was found dead in the very room that you are in over 4 years ago. It was most tragic. She fell while cleaning the shower. Most tragic, so very young and so pretty. We will be glad to provide you with another room." Iskander added, "You see, we wouldn't want you staying where you are uncomfortable, and the room does seem to be somewhat haunted." David remained in Tashkent another 4 days, in the same room, and never saw the girl again. To this day, he laughs about the experience and shrugs. "Some people will do anything to attract tourists," he says. "Some people like the idea of staying in a haunted house." Haunted. What a crock. Is it, David? Okay. This next one that I want to read is, I guess, about the same length. I probably have enough time for a couple more. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and play a short one here. And that'll give me a chance to light a cigarette and take a drink. This is under 2 minutes. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. Got one that's a few pages and then one that's just a couple of pages, and then we'll probably call it a show. This next one is called the Mamontovka tank. It was a beautiful day in the early spring of 2001, a day that I will never forget. The thaw came early that spring. It was the 25th of March, and already the temperatures were approaching the high 50s in the daytime and remaining in the 40s throughout the night. The snow had begun to melt more than a week earlier, and most of the local roads were open. It was an excellent weather for our planned outing. Conditions were near perfect. At 10 that morning, I met Walter and Sasha and their wives, Julia and Elena, along with Craig, longtime friends and fellow members of the Angels of the Battlefield, our local paranormal investigation society, on the Mamontovka Railroad platform. We proceeded from there on foot to my home, which is about a five-minute walk from the station. There, we had a quick snack and began preparing our equipment. Wally works for a major corporation, and Sasha is with the government. I can't mention the organization or the place where she works, but you can make any assumption that comes naturally to mind and most likely be correct. This is Russia, you know. In any case, we had an assortment of photographic equipment, some of which was definitely not available commercially with us. This included one camera specifically developed to handle infrared and low-light, no-light films. After our snack, we proceeded to our goal, the Mamontovka tank. The tank is kind of a landmark in our area. It is a remnant of a battle fought long ago. A German Tiger I heavy tank that was abandoned when it ran out of fuel in the face of the advancing Red Army in the spring of 1943. It is intact except for the motor, which was removed some years ago by an enterprising entrepreneur who is now using the big 8-cylinder Daimler diesel to run a sawmill in the neighboring village of Klesma. Local residents take turns cleaning up the tank in the surrounding area, since the local children use the thing as a combination jungle gym and general clubhouse. Several years ago, the mayor of Mamontovka made the proposal to have the old tank towed away. More than two-thirds of the citizens, parents all, informed his honor that if the tank were to disappear, he would also, along with his tax collectors. The idea was never mentioned again. Almost every child in Mamontovka had some story to tell about the tank. All of them have felt or sensed that someone was watching them while they played, and some of them have actually caught glimpses of a figure in the nearby forest watching as they climb in and out of the massive vehicle playing at war. It was because of these reports we were making our expedition. The seven of us, my wife joined us, and our son, accompanied by a troop of the local kids, made our way to the tank, which is about a 10-minute walk from my house. Mamontovka isn't very big. We had not planned to do a full investigation of the site. All we intended to do was take a few photos and leave. Therein lay the problem. In addition to me, three others of our number are what should be described as extremely sensitive: Elena, Craig, and my wife. Elena can sense not only a presence, but the aura of a presence. That is, she can tell if the presence is good, evil, or indifferent. Veta is also highly empathetic with spirits and can discern their mood, whether they are happy, sad, lonely, and such. Craig is the most sensitive of the lot in that he has almost instant sensation if a spirit is present. We were more than 50 yards from the tank when Craig stopped, shook his head a bit, and said, "There's something here." Veta and Elena both acknowledged his comment, but neither had felt anything unusual at that point. We went on. Upon reaching the tank, we set up our tripods and mounted our cameras in order to photograph it from different angles. While the ladies manned the fixed cameras, Sasha, Walter, Craig, and I crawled onto the cowl of the behemoth and began to use our smaller cameras to photograph the top and eventually the inside. Being the smallest physically of the group, I was elected to enter the body of the old Panzer and photograph the inside. I made a tour of the turret area, then stepped down off the loader's platform into the body of the beast. Both the driver's and the gunner's hatch were open, so the lighting was pretty good. Still, I used my Pentax K1000 loaded with IR film, infrared, to photograph the inside. Then, after I had completed the heat-seeking tour, Wally lowered a battery-powered fluorescent lamp down the commander's hatch, and I took some standard black-and-white shots. The entire process took about 15 minutes. When I crawled out, Sasha crawled in with his special camera, a starlighter that requires no light at all. Once he was firmly and solidly inside, we closed the hatches and left him in the dark. 5 minutes later, after crawling all over the old vehicle and taking shots from every possible angle, his balding head emerged through the commander's cupola. He had a broad grin on his face. Other than Craig's initial sensation, until this point, no one had sensed any presence around the tank. The ladies had exhausted a roll of film each, and our tripod-mounted cameras, a Canon EOS, and a locally manufactured Zenit, so we started breaking camp and prepared to go. By this time, our son and his companions had stood all they could and began to climb into the tank for a game of war. It was then that both Elena and Veta began to get a sensation of someone nearby. The feeling they picked up was one of concern. On Julia's notepad, the word no appeared several times in all capitals, underlined several times, and noted as being sensed by both Veta and Elena. Craig had also noticed and began to work his way toward a cluster of trees about 20 yards from the tank. Sasha, Walter, and I reloaded our cameras and started shooting in that direction. As Craig approached the tree line and Walter and I began to snap off photos, Elena suddenly looked directly at us and said, "No, don't. He doesn't want this." We both looked directly at her and asked the same question. "What?" "He doesn't want his picture made," she replied. "It's not a good idea." "He's afraid," Betta added. "He's afraid of being seen. He doesn't want to be seen." "Is he dangerous?" Walter asked, voicing my own concern as well. "No," Elena said. "He's not dangerous. He's..." She paused, afraid. "I'm hearing the word deserter," Betta added. "What is a deserter?" "Deserter," I asked. "Yes, that's it. A deserter is someone who runs from the army," I said. "Is he a deserter?" "I think so, and he's afraid to be seen." We kept shooting. By the time he reached the trees, some 200 yards from the tank, Craig had ceased having any sensation of a presence, as had Betta and Elena. Julia, who is not sensitive, had been taking field notes of the expedition and describing camera angles and other pertinent details, such as our lighting conditions and recording the impressions of our three sensitives. At this point, Sasha turned toward the tank, aimed his thermal camera, which resembles a pair of field glasses more than a traditional camera, and took one last frame. We finished packing and returned to my home, had another light snack, then headed to the platform. We were all interested in seeing the results of the expedition, so we traveled into Moscow and went over to the company where Wally worked to use the photo lab. He and I are both proficient film processors. It comes from spending something like 25 years each selling the product. The moment of truth came just over half an hour after we entered the lab. Out of a total shoot of 8 rolls of film, not counting Sasha's special film, which we were not equipped to process, we got absolutely nothing. Not a single picture developed. It was as though each camera, 4 different ones were used, had been opened and the film exposed to light. Each roll of film was the same, absolutely blank. Dumbfounded, we checked the processing unit. It was in perfect order. The chemicals were fresh. The machine was working without flaw. Frantic for a reason for this foul-up, we checked each camera. As unlikely as it seemed, it was possible that something had malfunctioned. All 4 were in good order. Each functioned just as it was supposed to. All of the light seals were solid, and all lenses and aperture adjustments were appropriate. We left the lab and went our separate ways, scratching our heads. We still had hope, Sasha had gone down to his office to have his film processed. Of course, their lab always works, and his camera is sealed light tight when the film is loaded, not on the spot but in the darkroom before he actually leaves on a shoot. At just after 10 p.m., we got the results from Savinov. Nothing. His camera had also malfunctioned. Someone, it appears, simply does not wish to be photographed. It is our consensus that the spirit of the tank is a deserter, one of the crew who decided to use the chaos of the moment to make a dash for freedom and was somehow killed in the area. We feel that he does not realize the war is over and therefore afraid of being photographed and therefore identified. We will, of course, try again. Next time, we will attempt direct contact with the spirit. Maybe he just needs to be told that it's finally over. The expedition was not a total failure, though. The following day, Sasha Savinov received the results of his attempts at thermal imaging of the tank. Mostly, they showed just what he expected, a tank sitting in the middle of the forest. The last frame, however, taken from the tree line as we were leaving the site, caught something entirely different and quite amazing. In the green and black haze, that is the thermal image, is the spectral and nearly transparent figure of a man, a young man, possibly in his 20s, dressed in the uniform of a German tank crewman. He stands erect in the cupola of the aging but pristine iron behemoth. His right hand shades his sunken dark eyes. His face is gaunt, and his eyes are narrowed in expression of what might be suspicion or perhaps fear as he watches us depart. We have about 3 minutes, a little less than three. We have 2.5. I'm going to go ahead and read this next one. You'll just have to catch it in the archives if I don't finish. But it's just a couple of pages, and then I'm going to play a song afterwards. If I remember correctly, this is a good one. This one is called The Church in the Wild Wood. The tired, haggard little group of old believers huddled together in the dim and smoky light of candles as the priest slowly swung the censer and began to solemnly intone the ancient words of the Mass. Unlike the majority of his parishioners, he was a young man with the build and strong hands of a worker. His scraggly black beard was unkempt and almost as threadbare as his vestments. They were all running a great risk in meeting to celebrate the Mass. It was the winter of 1935, and Stalin's NKVD, led by Nikolai Ezhov, was in the midst of a determined campaign to stamp out the last vestiges of religion in the Soviet Union. The little group was, quite literally, taking their lives in their hands. Their chapel, if one could call it that, was little more than a clapboard shack held together by faith and baling wire, located in the depths of the Siberian forest, some 20 miles northeast of Novosibirsk. The decrepit, forlorn-looking little building was shuttered and sealed as tightly as possible against even the slightest opening, both to keep the cold out and to keep the light and as much sound as possible in. Still, the melodious strains of the chants echoed through the dark stillness of the birch forest, and faint flickers of the candlelight glinted on the lush blanket of snow that covered the forest floor. Less than 20, the young priest thinks to himself, "But where a few are gathered." He finished the first section of the Mass, then mentioned to his congregation to join him. Softly but with conviction, they sang, "As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end." The door burst open and a cold blast of frigid air clouded with flakes of frost and snow ushered in the shapes of four heavenly laden men, four uniform, and each uniform had the dreaded green collar flash of the NKVD. The leader, a lieutenant about the same age as the priest, I just momentarily lost my spot here. The leader, a lieutenant about the same age as the priest, drew his pistol as his three companions leveled submachine guns on the assembled worshipers. "Anyone here," he announced, "who is not willing to die for their faith should leave now." He looked directly at the priest. I will give you exactly 1 minute to make up your minds. He pushed back his leather glove and looked sternly at his wristwatch. No one moved. Then faintly at first, but as a single voice, the old believers began to sing the litany for the dead. Very well, comrades, the lieutenant said as he took aim at the priest and slowly cocked back the hammer on his Nagant, N-A-G-A-N-T, revolver. I believe that is some sort of a brand. You have made your choice. Fire. The lieutenant's revolver barked, and the young priest fell forward, clutching at his chest. Then the air was ripped by the roar of submachine guns as the three troopers swept the room with the withering fire. In a matter of seconds, the decrepit little shack became a slaughterhouse. The air hung with a fine red haze made up of the blood of the believers who died there in the isolation of the forest, literally with the prayer on their lips. The aroma of incense and candle wax was joined by the acrid fumes of cordite and the bittersweet smell of death. Let me clear my throat. The officer motioned his troops outside, then slowly, methodically walked from body to body, seeking out the tiniest spark of life, and when it was found, snuffing it out once and for all with a pistol shot to the head. The next morning, the incident was forgotten by the victorious Czechists. They sat in their warm office in Novosibirsk and drank vodka as they boasted to their comrades of the enemies of the people they had executed the night before, rather than speak of helpless old believers they had butchered in cold blood. The tired, haggard little group of old believers huddled together in the dim and smoky light of candles as the priest slowly swung the censer and began to solemnly intone the ancient words of the Mass. Unlike the majority of his parishioners, he was a young man with the build and strong hands of a worker. His scraggly black beard was unkempt and almost as threadbare as his vestments. Now, everything I'm reading here for a little bit is in italics. Their chapel, if one could call it that, was a little more than a clapboard shack held together by faith and baling wire, located in the depths of the Siberian forest, some 20 miles northeast of Novosibirsk. The decrepit, forlorn-looking little building was shuttered and sealed as tightly as possible against the slightest opening, both to keep the cold out and to keep the light and as much sound as possible in. Still, the melodious strain of the chants echoed through the dark stillness of the birch forest, and faint flickers of the candlelight glinted on the lush blanket of snow that covered the forest floor. Less than 20, the young priest thinks to himself, but where a few are gathered. He finished the first section of the Mass, then motioned to his congregation to join him. Softly, but with conviction, they sang, "As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end." That ends the italics portion of this. And it is, too, anyone passing through this remote section of woods can hear them as they sing the ancient chant every night, just as they have for the last 69 years. End. Okay, I'm going to play a song to go out with here. And I'm not sure when the next one will be, but I'm going to try and get in as many as I can before Samhain, also known as Halloween. So, anyhow, let me get to this next one. So, until next time.